Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I'm Gary Gramlin.
I'm Jenny Brenda.
And I'm Connor Orr.
And guys, we are through the first Sunday of the 2021 season. We had a pretty topsy-turvy day. We had some surprises. We had some not very surprising things. And we're actually going to start with one of those. And that was the Sunday night football game and the Rams debut for Matthew Stafford, which went pretty much exactly as Sean McVay would have drawn it up.
Yeah, I mean, right from the beginning of the game, the Rams' third play from scrimmage was that 67-yard touchdown to Van Jefferson. You know, Matthew Stafford bootlegs to the left, and he throws the ball across the hash marks to Jefferson, who, you know, then was untouched and ran the remainder into the end zone. But just that play was representative of why they made a change at quarterback, the physical talent that Stafford brings, the expectations that have been raised. I mean, you could see the Rams defenders on the sideline. Jalen Ramsey was essentially skipping up and down with glee. So everyone there is excited about how much the ceiling has been raised by pairing Matthew Stafford with Sean McVay. And Sunday night was kind of the long-awaited debut we all thought it would be.
I think the best way to look at the Rams offense is, at its best, like what Sean McVay wants it to be, is that every play is accomplishing something on like a micro level, but also on a macro level, right? Where it's setting something up down the road and you're drawing somebody in, or you're making the defense believe that you're trying to do something with this one play. And then eventually, you know, you will have that one or two or three plays that break the game wide open and destroy your opponent and ruin their lives. And now Matthew Stafford can execute those plays with regularity. He can ruin everybody's life constantly, and it just seemed like every time he dropped back to pass, there were wide open wide receivers. It looked bananas out there. It looked Chip Kelly in 2013 Philadelphia Eagles crazy, and I'm all for it. Only it's going to stay. It's not going to go away. They're not going to take Sean McVay away like they took Chip away from me.
I mean, that's kind of the thing here. We went through a couple of seasons with, you know, guys like Sean McVay and Kyle Shanahan, and there are others, but, you know, we looked at those guys and sort of said, like, oh, the beauty of having a Sean McVay or a Kyle Shanahan is you don't need a great quarterback. Just get someone who fits the system and go ahead, and they'll make that guy good. And this is the first season that we're really seeing, like, oh, wait, what if you actually gave them a really good quarterback? Couldn't you do a lot more? And if you're wondering why it's significant that Matthew Stafford is now Sean McVay's quarterback, just watch, you know, go back and watch the 67-yard touchdown pass to open this game to Van Jefferson, where it's a play where Stafford rolls left and then is throwing back outside the right hash mark downfield. It was actually very similar to a throw that Trey Lance made that was kind of eye-popping in the preseason. But that kind of play, you can't call that play with Jared Goff as your quarterback. That's just not in your toolbox. So the way Sean McVay can sort of now allow his imagination to run wild a little bit and put this incredible amount of stress both vertically and horizontally, the amount of field you now have to cover against the Rams, it's an absolute game changer.
Yeah, and the Rams made a decisive move there, right? I mean, they went to a Super Bowl with Goff. Mm-hmm. They gave him an extension, but they still said, you know what? This isn't good enough. We can do so much more. The ceiling could be higher, and we're willing to go and do that.
You watch a Patrick Mahomes and a Josh Allen and a Lamar Jackson and a Justin Herbert elsewhere, and you kind of say, like, huh, what if I had that here? But I do want to talk about the Bears side of this just a little bit. We saw a nice drive to start this game that ended up with a tipped interception in the red zone. But overall, I mean, look, I think Andy Dalton was kind of what you would expect him to be in this offense, that just they don't have the supporting cast to sort of lift up Andy Dalton in the way that he has to be lifted up. And if this was a different roster, you could probably get by with Dalton as your starter, but it's just not the case in Chicago right now. You have a guy on the bench that is, we don't know how ready he is. He's probably not terribly ready. They don't do a lot of stuff in that Ohio State offense that would translate to what they do in Chicago, but it's sooner rather than later, it's probably going to have to be Justin Fields here, especially after what we saw tonight in the opener.
Yeah, and I think you hear a lot the comparison, oh, well, Matt Nagy was in Kansas City when Patrick Mahomes sat his whole rookie season, but it's not the same thing. Alex Smith had success in that offense. They were building the offense that Mahomes is starring in with Alex Smith at that point in time. It's a very different situation. Andy Dalton is not Alex Smith, right? And so you get to a point where Matt Nagy has to look at his locker room, and there are players every week who are showing up, playing a dangerous game with 100% injury risk. Players on the defensive side of the ball, which was a defense that was ready to win championships the last few years, but was frustrated with the offense already. And you have to be able to answer them honestly and say, no, Andy Dalton gives us the best chance to win. And how can you tell them that after, you know, a game like this and potentially more games down the line that you're not going to put Justin Fields in there when the players know what they've seen at practice and they need that spark? It's going to be hard to answer the players in your locker room at a certain point, maybe already.
And it's weird because, and I'm not couching Justin Fields, who scored, in this game, as a mobile quarterback. But even if the rest of his game is going to take time to translate at the NFL level, he can already do more for you as strictly a mobile quarterback if that's all you were going to do with him this year than Andy Dalton was going to do for you anyway. Like, if you look at what Andy Dalton's night was, if any of you had to venture a guess, how many passes beyond 10 yards do you think that Andy Dalton completed on Sunday Night Football?
Oh, boy. I'm going to say two, because I'm going to say they probably got in a couple like 3rd and 16 situations and got 12 yards.
What do you think, Jenny?
All right. I'll go with a 3.
Waiting all day for 0 completions above 10 yards.
Wow. I mean,
everything. There's no trust in the offensive line. No trust in the offensive line. And you can't trust the offensive line. You can't trust Andy Dalton behind the offensive line like that. I mean, he's historically, you go over his career, his worst moments are always when he has to play in a muddy pocket. And this is only a muddy pocket there. Justin Fields, I mean, you're absolutely right, Connor. Justin Fields could at least, protect himself here with his mobility. Not to say Andy Dalton's completely immobile, but he's not mobile enough to survive beyond this behind this offensive line here. Man, 0.
And I guess this wouldn't surprise you, but guess how many passes they even attempted of 20 yards or more.
I feel pretty confident.
0, 0, 0.
Stafford
completed 2 passes of 20 yards or more, and completed, 7 passes of 10 yards or more, and 3 of them were scores. Dalton was basically lived in the line of scrimmage to the 10. Almost all of his passes actually were on the to the right from like one side. So, that was not a good look.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, just to kind of wrap this up, if you're Matt Nagy and you're in that locker room, like what you said, Jenny, you can't look at like Akeem Hicks and Khalil Mack and be like, guys, best thing is for Justin Fields to sit most of this year, but like just wait until it pays off in like 2024 when you guys are no longer in the NFL. It just, you can't sell it. He will lose the locker room, and it can't be long. This team has suffered through too much horrific quarterback play for this to go on.
Yeah, and obviously tanking is a whole separate topic and conversation, but there's the same underlying idea that it's different in football than it is in other sports because of the violence and the inherent danger in the sport and basically the risk that you assume every time you go out there.
Well, we have to talk about what happened in Kansas City today with the future Super Bowl champion or runner-up or participant, Super Bowl participant, Cleveland Browns, who, I don't know, I'm not going to say they're the better team than the Chiefs. They were the better team on Sunday, though.
Yeah, I thought a good showing by the Browns, who many people are saying, I've said, are going to either make the Super Bowl or win the Super Bowl. And so I thought it was the team that I got excited about this year. And I think that the Chiefs are just going to be able to do those Chiefsian things that are going to allow them to get back into games that they don't deserve to get back into. So the Tyreek Hill touchdown at the end of the game, which is essentially a broken play that Mahomes can sort of survive a pass rush a la a far more athletic Ben Roethlisberger and make a 10 times more difficult throw to a receiver who can escape even the tightest coverage and give himself a 2 or 3 yard window to run. These are just things that other teams don't have and can't defend. And so beyond that, I think that Cleveland outplayed Kansas City and they had a bad punt snap and they had one kind of exceptional play get away from him. But I think this bodes extraordinarily well. There were running game, there were running lanes in this game for Nick Chubb that were just phenomenally wide. I thought the game plan was solid. The defense played good. You know, this is, this is my Super Bowl Browns right here.
I think that's the problem, though, when you're playing against the Chiefs and you're playing in a conference with the Chiefs,
yeah,
is that they can get back into the game in just a second, in a flash, right, with some unbelievable play, and it can make up for the fact that they weren't at their best the rest of the game, or they don't have Tyrann Mathieu. I mean, that's the other thing too, is that they were playing this game without the heart and soul of their defense, and clearly the person who makes a lot of things work. So it's heartening on the one sense because they outplayed the Chiefs for the majority of the game, but then it's also disheartening because you can outplay the Chiefs for the majority of the game and then they can still win.
I don't want to be the guy who sort of rolls out the, if you take away all the good plays the Chiefs had, they didn't have a very good game at all. But if you take away the 75-yard touchdown, which again, that's a Mahomes play. I mean, that's what he does, so it's not necessarily surprising, but it's also kind of like if you're the defense, you just kind of shrug your shoulders and be like, well, what, you know, what else can we do at this point? But if you take away that play, 5.3 yards per play for the Chiefs today. You know, that Mahomes would have been down around like 260 yards on the game in a game that they trailed for most of it. So it just becomes a very pedestrian statistical performance for the Chiefs at this point. And look, they had protection issues. We know they addressed the offensive line. We also know the Browns are really good up front. Myles Garrett looked like a Defensive Player of the Year candidate. Jadeveon Clowney met him at the quarterback a couple of times. I mean, it's a really good defense, but the Chiefs were not good up front. Some of that is, you know, Orlando Brown Jr. Does he translate outside of that Ravens offense to a more traditional offense effectively? We're going to find out as the year goes on, but there were also just some straight-up miscommunications up front that that just sort of allowed some easy pressures here for Cleveland. So, you know, part of it's chemistry, part of it's, you know, maybe you're a little bit undermanned still, but I don't know, some work to do here for the Chiefs, but they still walk away with a win over one of the best teams in the AFC.
Yeah, the offensive line is such an important discussion point because that was why the Chiefs didn't win back-to-back Super Bowls, was because things broke down up front. How many months ago was that? 7 months ago, right? And there were some similarities in the fact that Mahomes was on the run a lot. Even the play to Tyreek Hill, he was on the run. There were times the touchdown run of his, things broke down and he ran in. And listen, we see that a lot from Mahomes, but also you can't be so reliant on him being able to do that every time. Yes, he has that otherworldly skill to be able to throw off balance or from whatever different plane he happens to be on at any given point in time. But there were times in this game when it just was reminiscent of the Super Bowl and that he was scrambling around, trying to extend plays, trying to make things work. And ultimately, with the remake of the offensive line, they want to get to a point where that's not a necessary part of winning a game, that he has to do those things, you know, as many times as he is.
That's what I think is really interesting about the read offense in general. And you're seeing it, you see it a lot more from the disciples of his who don't understand how to kind of stitch those concepts into more of a game plan with a flow. If that makes sense. But sometimes I think Andy does fall back on that too, where a lot of his ideals are, and this goes back to Donovan McNabb, and in that is you're forcing your quarterback to do a lot of hero ball stuff, right? You know, you're forcing your quarterback to drop back, and maybe it's not necessarily laid out for you like it is in other offenses. You're forcing them to make difficult throws. You're asking them to utilize the best of their abilities. And with Patrick Mahomes, that's fine, except for when the offensive line doesn't allow for that to happen, and you still have a quarterback that we forget is young and is learning to process things at an NFL level. I don't think it's a bold take to say that, like, Patrick Mahomes is still learning his protections. He's still getting comfortable with all this stuff, how defenses are going to attack him. And so sometimes the convergence of this, like, hero ball mentality and the fact that he's still learning does lead to these little lapses, I think, in performance.
Yeah, and if you're the Browns, I mean, you're bummed out that you took a loss. I think the most negative thing you'd say about this is they did have two possessions, trailing by four with chances to go and sort of retake the lead here, and it just didn't work. The game ends on Baker Mayfield interception, where it looked like a throwaway, and he kind of got he got his heels clipped as he was trying to release the ball, and that ended up being short-armed and picked off, which is, you know, just kind of a bad break at that point. But yeah, you'd like to be able to put some points on the board on one of those drives and steal this thing in Kansas City. But, you know, it's the way it goes sometimes when you face Patrick Mahomes. Speaking of offensive line issues, I guess we'll start there with the Saints-Packers game that ended up just being a complete blowout. I mean, I don't know exactly when we've seen the Packers look this bad with Aaron Rodgers, and they have had some shaky games, you know, not as often as the last couple of years, but, you know, they got manhandled pretty good in San Francisco in the regular season and in the playoffs in 2019. We've seen some bad performances, but this one seemed worse than their worst performances. Like, I'd almost put it in the same area of, like, when they went down to Tampa early last season and got blown out. They just look completely outclassed here.
What's interesting, via Pro Football Focus, if Aaron Rodgers had just thrown the ball into the ground after every snap, he would have had a higher quarterback rating than what he attempted on Sunday. And so it's kind of stunning, and it's one of those things where afterwards he said, well, it is just one game, and he's right. And I do think that Green Bay is still going to walk away pretty handily with that division. I mean, the Vikings lost to the Bengals, so it's not like, you know, this is a team that's going to come back and challenge them in any way, shape, or form. But at the same time, this is not one of those games that you can just, you know, relax away with the fan base. I think there were some really, you know, there's some really startling, kind of deep-rooted stuff going on here that maybe they were able to scheme around for a while, but, you know, maybe got identified at some point here.
Yeah, you don't see the Packers with Aaron Rodgers getting that outclassed very often. It was, as you said, very jarring, and nothing was working, right? The run game, I'm looking at the stats here, they're also miserable. As Connor noted, Rodgers' stats were miserable. So it, I think the offensive line is a good starting point, Gary, for what went wrong, but clearly it went far beyond that.
I think people maybe lost track of how good the Saints defense is because they did get off to a bit of a shaky start in 2020, especially in the secondary where they're kind of mixing in some new parts. But by the end of the year, they looked dominant, and they obviously looked dominant in this one. But this game was, I don't know, it was supposed to be some sort of signal to us as to whether or not the Jameis Winston era would be successful or not. And in the end, it was kind of like this defensive performance made it a moot point. You could have put anyone back there. This could have been an Ian Book game, and the Saints would have won it handily. So I don't know. You kind of shrug your shoulders. I mean, that's, you know, Jameis didn't really have to do a whole lot in this one.
But I will say it was clear that Sean Payton trusts Winston, and I think there were a few plays that reinforced that. There was the fourth and goal pass where they went up 17-0. The third and seven at the end of the third quarter where they passed to go up 23-3, right? You don't have to be aggressive in those situations necessarily, but Sean Payton obviously trusted Jameis enough to be aggressive at certain points in the game. So I think it's sort of, you know, if you read reports from New Orleans, it seemed like Winston was the clear favorite for to win the job for a while. And evidently this is why, that Sean Payton feels like he can give him a lot and he'll be fine handling it, which has never been the case with Jameis in his career.
I will say, to throw cold water on a little bit of the whole Jameis thing, like, so his quarterback rating today was better than at any point during the Bruce Arians, Byron Leftwich, coaching tandem. However, like, three of the five touchdown passes, and again, this is going to sound nitpicky, but three of the five touchdown passes, okay, one's a shovel pass, right? One was an alley-oop and, like, a phenomenally contested catch in the end zone, which, like, you would put maybe, like, 15% on the quarterback there and 85% on the receiver. Yeah. And then the other one, on the opposite side of the end zone, where the wide receiver, there was not a single person in that third of the end zone, was still almost an incompletion. Like, the receiver made a phenomenal play to keep that from being a horrendously awful throw, you know? So I do think, like, there's still a lot of Jameis in there that needs to get shaken out. And everybody that's just assuming that they converted or fixed a busted first-round pick and they've now pressed the accelerator on the next 10 years of their franchise, I think needs to just hold on a little bit.
You're saying he threw too many touchdown passes in this game. No, I will say, to your point, and your point is absolutely right. I mean, you know, five touchdowns is not really a very indicative stat of what went on in this game. But he had one end zone interception. It was a seam throw. Defender had his back to the ball. He ended up, the ball was just off target enough to hit the defender in the back, deflected, got picked off. That one got erased by, you know, your weekly, extremely questionable roughing the passer call. But
dubious.
Yeah, there were two of them in the 425 frame. But, I don't know. I don't think we really learned a whole lot about Jameis Winston this game, but we probably did learn that this Saints team is going to be really good because that defense is really good. This next game, I'm going to really lean into this because this is the one preseason prediction I made that is looking good through 72 hours of the season, and that is the Steelers go up to Buffalo and steal one in very Steelers style. I thought this game looked a lot like the last two meetings, both Sunday night games between the Steelers and Bills. It was weird to watch this in the 1 o'clock window. There was frustration that the Steelers were still really just going with a quick strike horizontal stuff in the first half, but they did open it up a little bit in the second half. I mean, this is a team that had 53 yards at halftime and trailed. They ended up picking up, before Neil Downs, 201, and they also got a long pass interference penalty in the second half. They moved the ball in the second half. They had, at that point, invited the Bills to basically stack the box at that point, but they ended up opening up the offense a little bit, and it ends up working. And they also got a blocked punt touchdown, but they moved the ball in the second half, and obviously we know what this defense does to people, both from a, you know, slowing an offense and also forcing turnovers. So this is stylistically how the Steelers want to win games, and when you go on the road to one of the blue bloods in your conference and get a win, I mean, that's I don't know. I want everyone to apologize to me and tell me how smart I am for saying the Steelers would be good this year. That's all.
In defense of my colleague, this is not a correct Gary Gramling prediction. This is a correct Jenny Vrentis prediction, which is that the Buffalo Bills are going to take a step back this year. Jenny was the one who said that. The Buffalo Bills clearly gave this game away, and there's nothing inspiring about the Steelers in any way, shape, or form. So, again, I think if nothing else, regardless of how consistent or inconsistent my own ideas of my own predictions are, I feel like I've been in the prediction business long enough to be able to officiate prediction making, and Jenny is the one who correctly predicted this outcome.
I think we can give both of us can get a check in the column for now after week one, and you know. Should be noted that with this new 17-game schedule, that each game means even less than it did last year. So that is probably something that will be shared in half the buildings around the league this week. But I mean, I think it was a quality win for the Steelers to, and one that I didn't expect. I picked the Bills, so good for Gary with his prediction there. I did wonder why it took until the second half to open up the offense more. That was a little bit confounding. And the block punt obviously was the catalyst for the Steelers to kind of get back into things. And TJ Watt, another strip sack. His strip sack numbers were down a little bit last year, but good to see him, you know, off to a good start there, although he has competition as usual from Chandler Jones in that category.
Oh, we'll get to Chandler Jones yeah. a little bit later and what he did to the, I think the entire city of Nashville is still feeling that. Yeah, I'll just say this. Connor, you're a distance runner. I think you of all people could appreciate the Steelers' approach to pacing themselves in the first half of this game before really going for it. What do you call it? They their kick at the end. Is that a thing?
A kick is a thing. I would say that. I'm trying to poke a hole in your analogy because I just don't like the Steelers, and I'm just trying to shut this whole thing down. Fair enough, maybe. Like, I guess with Mike Tomlin, you could make an argument that there's some sort of a Belichickian thing afoot here where you're only trying to do the bare minimum to be able to win games, and then at the end of the year, you shapeshift into some different-looking offense. That said, I would probably say it's a lot easier to do with Tom Brady and not like a decomposing Ben Roethlisberger behind center, but, you know, your faith in this team to me loses a little bit of we'll get to the Jaguars who you said I think we're going to make the AFC title game this year, and again it's just it's difficult for me to totally get behind this right now.
Okay, so to be clear, the Jaguars are one of the many teams where I go into pre-production meetings and say, like, I don't know, guys, I think this team's got something, and I'll say it about 29 teams so that I can come back at the end of the year and be like, oh, guys, remember that time where I said I said the Texans would go 15-2 and then went on the podcast and said they'd go 1-16?
It's the Good Morning Football strategy. Did you ever watch that show? Every day it's just like between the end of the previous season and the beginning of the next season, they're just like, I don't know, guys, the Raiders. And then, like, you know, they'll just do that with every single team. And then when one team goes on a roll, it's like, remember back in June when we were like the Raiders? And it's like, yeah, well, if you do that every day for 32 days, you have 32 clips of that. So you know, it's very convenient, you know. Not all of us are true by-the-books oracles who are willing to live and die with their predictions.
That's true. We did get from Gary before we did the season prediction show. Gary was like, yeah, I considered putting the Jaguars in the playoffs, but decided not to. But he conveniently told us, maybe we were even like recording, you know, press record before the show actually starts.
See?
And maybe he was secretly hoping that like producer Shelby was keeping that footage on the off chance that his prediction was right. Well, if that was the case, then today, well, probably dashed some hopes, knocked Gary a little bit back down to earth despite seeing his Steelers soar. That was quite a performance from the Jaguars.
So I'll start this off by saying, and look, I know I questioned the Texans and what they were doing defensively with Lovie Smith and with the personnel they have and how it didn't really make a whole lot of sense, but it's a defense that plays hard and they played fast and they made a lot of impressive plays in this game. But boy, this Jaguars team, this was the most ill-prepared team I can remember going into a professional football game at any level that I've seen in like the last 5 years. My jaw was just like on the floor watching them play.
Yeah, so they looked like it was almost like the two highest ranking coaches on the staff had never coached in professional football before, and then the two people who you tasked with scheming the offense to beat the Tampa 2 defense were Brian Schottenheimer and Daryl Bevel, who, like, both only won games at the hands of generational defenses. So, yeah, phenomenal effort top to bottom by the Jaguars. Now, the Texans will be the Jaguars of last year, where they came out and they won a game at the beginning of the season, and everyone was like, whoa, maybe we didn't know. No, this team is going, you know, 1-16 or whatever, 2-14, whatever. But 3-14. It was satisfying a little bit to just see the pants pulled down on Urban Meyer, because, you know, there was that air of, you know, I got this. I can figure this out. I know what I'm doing. And while that may be true in the long run, it is not true right now on Sunday when we're recording this podcast.
Yeah, I think it was easy to get sucked into the idea that Trevor Lawrence is this player the NFL's been waiting to see, we've been waiting to see, right, at the NFL level, and that he's this unique talent that maybe would have the ability to uplift the roster around him. I think that preseason game against the Saints was the reality check, at least for me, when I was like, wait a second. No, like, if you can't do it alone in the NFL, and if the roster around you needs a lot of improvement and has been built in a somewhat questionable way, then it's not going to work. And I think we saw the product of that. And as for the Texans, you know, that was a team that played really hard. And it's been a, you know, really unusual situation for Tyrod Taylor. He goes into this team, you know, Deshaun Watson is not playing because he's facing 22 allegations of sexual misconduct and criminal investigation. And also, he doesn't want to be in Houston. And yet they don't name Taylor the starter until, what was it, I don't know, week 10 days before the opener. And he sort of has to play along with this strange messaging, being asked questions about things that he doesn't really have any say over. And he's had a really strange career, including last season when he, you know, gets a lung punctured seconds before the season opener, and he has that opportunity taken away from him, and then obviously Justin Herbert runs away with it. So, you know, for Tyrod Taylor, it was probably a pretty nice day.
I think we have the ability to both view the Texans as this strangely mismanaged cultish hellfire, and also the separate ability to appreciate Tyrod Taylor, who, like, to your point, like, lost the job in LA from getting his lung punctured, lost the job in Cleveland for getting concussed, I believe, or a head injury, right, where he had to leave the game and Baker Mayfield came in, lost the job in Buffalo because, you know, there was just this crazy idea that he wasn't good enough to have the job, despite making a Pro Bowl. And so, I think the one nice thing about this Houston team is there are a bunch of players who are probably going to get traded at the deadline and go to other places because they're very tradable veteran contracts, and they will be gutted once the team will gut themselves once they realize how crappy they are, and they will then get to continue their career somewhere else. And I hope that that's Tyrod Taylor, because I think in my heart of hearts can be like a Jimmy Garoppolo plus type player where he can get a team deep into the playoffs. I think he's certainly good enough to do that.
So yeah, Tyrod made a handful of really impressive plays today that were sort of out of structure. Tim Kelly just designed a really good offense. They were heavy on pick plays, heavy on crossers. The number of times you had Jaguars defenders throwing up their hands after giving up a play and looking at each other and yelling at each other. I mean, it was an offense that just absolutely out-schemed the Jaguars defense. And then, look, offensively, we know the Jaguars aren't great up front. Trevor Lawrence was moving around a lot, even against a Texans pass rush that maybe isn't terribly formidable. But Trevor Lawrence just didn't seem comfortable with what he was seeing. He threw three interceptions in this game. I'll give the quick breakdown on each. The first one was just a flat-out misthrow. He was moving to his left. He tried to make a play, and he just sailed the throw, and it was an easy interception. That was the only one where you'd say, like, boy, that is just an atrocious physical play. The second one, he just misread a defense. It was a cover-two look. The the cornerback dropped with enough depth that it was clear he was not going to be able to fit a throw into that deeper hole. They were giving him the short throw to the flat on a second and long, and he tried to force something, and it was a terrible idea. It got intercepted. The third one was a miscommunication with Laviska Shenault. Clearly, I don't know who was right or who was wrong, but the ball ended up just going nowhere near a Jaguars receiver. But the reason I sort of highlight those last two is that's so, you know, it's stuff that happens to a rookie, and that's the way it goes. But it is also why you give your rookie quarterback as many reps as he can possibly get over the course of the summer, instead of, say, giving half of the first team snaps during training camp to the backup quarterback, who you then end up trading because you want to make some silly point about competition or whatever that might be. Now, that was not going to save the Jaguars in this game. They were going to lose no matter how well Trevor Lawrence performed, because their whole team performance was that bad. But it's just such an inefficient waste of a training camp to end up doing that, unless there's some long play with giving Gardner Minshew half of the first team snaps that we just don't realize yet. It's some sort of 4D chess that we will come to realize in January when the Jaguars are preparing for the AFC title game that I may or may not have predicted off air.
Sounds like a coaching mistake.
Setting a dangerous precedent for producer Shelby, by the way, to invite him to tape the pre-show discussions.
That is, yeah.
The amount of blackmail material he has.
There actually is quite a lot accumulated over the last few weeks. Yeah. I don't know if you noticed, but I started saying, Shelby, that is not for use in the show, because I started getting nervous.
If any of us had any money, Shelby would be a rich man right now.
Quietly the most powerful person at Sports Illustrated.
True.
Oh, Patriots-Dolphins. This one was, I'll say two things about this game to set it off. It's super weird when these teams play, because it's just, they're the same team. They just wear different uniforms. They're the same schematically. They're the same approach. All that stuff. This one particularly with Kyle Van Noy being back on the Patriots, and now like guys like Jason McCourty being on the Dolphins, you know, like I have a lot of games going at once on Sunday afternoon, and you're kind of like, I'm listening for, and when I hear like oh, Jason McCourty with the pass breakup, and I'm like, oh, this is so disorienting. Wait, what team was that good for? I don't know anymore. But that's kind of what this was. And we got a game that was just a back and forth sort of conservative, low scoring. I don't want to quite call it a slog, because I think it was a little bit crisper than that. But this was a very Patriots-Dolphins game.
Yeah, and for it to be decided essentially on a Patriots mistake is not the kind of thing that goes over well in Foxborough, obviously, because they're known as a team that generally likes to avoid or tries to minimize those mistakes probably better than anyone else in the league. But if you are a Patriots fan or a person who works in the Patriots organization, you do have to feel good about the way Mac Jones played. I mean, Gary, you just mentioned with Trevor Lawrence the bizarre rep mismanagement by the Jaguars throughout the preseason, and it was the opposite, right? Even though Mac Jones was competing with Cam Newton, Mac Jones was steadily getting more and more reps, even though they weren't sure he was going to be the day one starter. And they made sure he had enough reps to be ready for the game. And I think you have to be excited about the way he threw the ball. I mean, first of all, he threw an excellent wheel route to James White, which is pretty much the first throw you need to master if you're going to be the Patriots starting quarterback. Did an excellent job with that, but just really was in command, didn't seem flustered. You know, of the five rookie quarterbacks, I mean, a lot of them didn't play much. So, well, two of them didn't play much. We saw a brief appearance of Trey Lance. We were recording this part before the night game is over, but we saw Justin Fields for a brief play in the first half, and who knows what will happen the rest of the game. But regardless, he was the best rookie quarterback appearance from this year's class. And of course, it's just week one, but I think there was my takeaway from that game was that Mac Jones looks like the real deal.
I agree. And, you know, for anybody that's trying to still make sweeping conclusions about the Patriots, I mean, you know, the mistakes were things like running back fumbles where, you know, the Patriots have had the same running backs coach for 25 years. It's not like anything has changed. You know, Ivan Fears has been there for, you know, forever. And so none of this stuff is like, to me, showing any cracks in the foundation or anything. It's like, you know, rookies making, you know, strange little rookie mistakes that are going to happen. But to both of your points, when a team knows you that intimately, I think that just increases the inevitability that some of this stuff is going to happen. So I think once Mac Jones is unleashed on the rest of the division, which is starting, you know, we don't know what the Bills are, but the Jets obviously didn't look phenomenal. I think that we're going to start to see the full picture of what he might look like.
And yeah, so sort of to Connor's point, Ramondre Stevenson, the rookie running back who lost a fumble, and then we did not see any of him again in this game. I mean, it was a play where, you know, it's a fraction of a second. I mean, there's like a millimeter between his glute muscle and the turf when the ball comes loose, and you know that's a really tight play. And then Xavien Howard made a play on Damian Harris when the Patriots were seemingly setting up for the go-ahead and likely game-winning field goal late in the fourth quarter, and that's how that game ended up turning. On the other side is Tua Tagovailoa. It's a tough game to really get a great read on a quarterback just because the Patriots are still really good defensively. They throw a lot of stuff at you. It's a veteran defensive backfield. We know they're really good. I did notice, I mean, look, Jalen Waddle creates separation in a way that the Dolphins receivers did not last year. That was a big plus. It seemed like Tagovailoa had a little more trust in Devontae Parker in this one. Tua also threw, I mean, I don't know what to say about the interception other than it's completely just unforgivable for your quarterback to do that in the fourth quarter of a one-point game on a third down just to chuck a prayer at midfield, which, you know, it got batted around by about three people and was intercepted, which was probably the most likely outcome of that throw anyway. And it's just, I don't know how you basically sharpen that because it's such an egregious error, but he does not have margin for error as a guy who is really reliant on less on sort of out of structure playmaking and traits and stuff like that, and just has to be more reliant on accuracy and good decision making. That was as egregious a bad decision as I can remember a quarterback making in recent memory here.
You wonder if inevitably, like, what the Patriots are doing with Mac Jones will rub off a little bit on the Dolphins, because that's what Tua was. I mean, he was a very good RPO quarterback at Alabama. Mm-hmm. He was good at throwing the ball on time. You know, he was good at a few design reads that he could hit, and then if he needs to escape the pocket, he can escape the pocket. But I think allowing that to be a bigger part of the offense than it needs to be only invites moments like that where, you know, and I understand that he's made some great plays on the run and he's, you know, he is valuable in that aspect of it, but why not, you know, kind of continue with the training wheels until, you know, you feel it's a little bit more safe to take care, take them off, you know?
So out in Indianapolis, the Seahawks come east and win again. They always win when they come east, it seems. This was a pretty comfortable win for Seattle, and we'll start with their side of the coin real quick here. We really only saw it for a half because they sort of let off the gas in the second half playing with a two-possession lead, but I thought there was a ton of encouraging stuff from the Shane Waldron and Russell Wilson marriage here. You know, is Waldron going to be the guy who sort of maximizes Wilson for a full season for the first time? And, I mean, you saw some really good signs. You know, you got the usual play-action stuff. You got a couple of moon balls to Tyler Lockett, but you saw some just route combinations at the intermediate level that it seems like they just don't really, they haven't really tried with Russell Wilson in the past. And Waldron drew those up and they got executed on time and it just looked really good against what's a pretty good Colts defense.
Yeah, it looked like something that could be sustainable over the course of the season, which, you know, of course, what we saw last year was great for five games and then you know, the offense became something else because you can't just win games like that the entire year. But this looked like something that could be a, you know, replicable foundation. And, you know, we don't want to get too excited after 1 week, but it did look like a promising start to their relationship.
I think this is where, this is the advantage in hiring, like, people from the Sean McVay tree. Like, it's annoying that all of these guys are immediately promoted to head coach, but when you're bringing in people from the tree, I think this is where it's valuable and somewhat of an immediate return on your investment, because regardless of how good of a coach they are, they're going to be exposed to the thought process of some of these coaches who create these great mismatches, and you could just simply overlay those ideas onto your roster, where it's like, oh, okay, well, here in LA we did this, why don't we try that with you know, Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf, and you know, it's gonna work because they're talented players, and it injects a little bit of new life into the offense. But yeah, I just thought it was a fantastic performance. They're not really giving away any indicators where, you know, Russell Wilson threw to every single corner of the field with accuracy. They ran the ball well, and it, you know, they schemed open players. Like, I think Next Gen Stats does a great job of that average receiver separation. The league average is 2.8 yards. DK Metcalf was almost double that on every throw. So imagine, like, being double open, you know, and you're all also like 6'4 and gigantic and already able to create your own separation. So I think good on the new offense. I think there's a lot to like about it.
DK Metcalf should have a gentleman's agreement to not separate, because it's just unfair at that point. Touching on the Colts real quick, Carson Wentz, they definitely had the training wheels on to an extent. He was not the out-of-control quarterback we saw a year ago. He did lose one fumble on an effort play that you know, was not a huge issue in this one. The one thing that kind of stood out to me, and you have to see the All-22 before you can really make a judgment on it, there were clearly a couple of, especially third down plays, where the ball was clearly supposed to come out quickly, and it did not. He held it, and he took a sack, or for whatever reason, it didn't play out. But sort of in relation to that, I do want to highlight one guy on the Seahawks, because I have been sort of scratching my head on how this defense would work, and you know, it, really what they need to find is someone who's just a game changer on the defensive line, and I didn't think they had that guy. But Daryl Taylor, who he missed all of his rookie season, he was a mid-second round pick in 2020, and you know, kind of a forgotten guy at that point. I mean, he was absolutely dynamic in this game, and there was a fourth down sack he had on Wentz, and watching the play, I couldn't quite see who he was going up against, but I thought what had happened was the Colts had slid protection. Taylor came on a back, tried to hold him off, and I was like, oh, Wentz has to get that ball out, because he just steamrolled that blocker. That must have been a 180-pound running back. But no, when I watched the replay, it turned out it was Braden Smith. It was the Colts' right tackle that Daryl Taylor just absolutely de-cleated him and then finished off Carson Wentz. And he had a number of plays where he just looked like a potential game changer here for the Seahawks. And if that's the case, you know, it's maybe not going to come down to this offense scoring 30, 40 points every week for them to be in competition here in the NFC. So lots of encouraging stuff.
Smiling during this segment because I've been waiting for you to say that he maybe Daryl Taylor is the X factor. But you didn't deliver, and I just kept, every time I thought you were about to say it, I would break out into a grin. And if people are watching on YouTube, they're probably going to think I'm a strange Cheshire cat type person. But, you know, he could be their X factor. But it does seem like the Seahawks defense has, like, restudded with the kinds of players that made their defense great when they won the Super Bowl. You know what I mean? Like, they've had to rebuild and they've had to add young guys. And I think you're exactly right, Gary. Like, early last season, we were like, what the heck is their pass rush? Would they have a pass rush? And here was an answer of a player who could be making an impact beyond what maybe we projected.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I might have to reassess this team after week one, which is what you do after week one. You completely throw out everything you thought and hit the reset button on everything, but they might be onto something here with these young guys in Seattle, which is, I mean, look, that's how you have to build. You weren't going to have Cliff Avril and Cam Chancellor playing for 30 years, unfortunately.
Quickly, but, on the X-Factor front, Jenny's X-Factor, Jordan Brooks, led the team in solo tackles with 7.
Thank you, Connor.
No problem.
Just really keeping an eye out for my predictions this week. I appreciate it. And you're also ignoring all of the bad ones. So this is just a great day for me.
There you go. There you go.
Because you've all exposed me as a complete psychopath already, it's clear what I'm doing. So I'm just going to be honest about it. Now, setting the table for when all of mine come tumbling down, I then get the similar protection. Really lining up my tin soldiers here this week on the episode.
Got it.
You know?
Thanks for being honest.
Well, let's head out to Tennessee where the, I don't know, the main storyline was probably Michael Badgley's arrival as a, I don't know, a difference maker? A potential player who could swing things one way or the other for this Titans team. I'm not sure what you want to proclaim him, but he joined as a kicker and missed 2 of his 3 kicks in his Titans debut. But the story of this game was mostly Chandler Jones coming back, and I don't know what happens when you rupture your Achilles. I don't know what that rehab involves, but he looked like, I don't know, like a faster, stronger version of his own self. I don't know. I don't know.
Like maybe they put a spring where the Achilles used to be, and he was just kind of like launching forward off the line of scrimmage.
No, I was listening to our buddy Tim Rowan's podcast on Oscar Pistorius, and they were talking about all the biomechanics of his blades and all that stuff. But I don't know, maybe there's something going on there with Chandler Jones. Maybe he just got some sort of small rocket put into his old Achilles heel. So
would definitely be an interesting strategy, and we'll see if some players end up taking that to heart moving forward. But the Cardinals are
voluntarily severing their Achilles heel.
that's the trade-off, is you have to spend a season away and you have to voluntarily rupture your Achilles on the field. So like there will be a lot of snaps where guys will just be like running around banging their Achilles on the grass trying to rupture it, and then you go into that like the lab from Deadpool, and then you come out as like as new Chandler Jones.
It's kind of what this was, yeah.
Yeah, really what this serves to me is to prove again that I'm wrong about everything, and I was super down on the Cardinals. Cardinals fans, when my predictions came out this year, were like, well, we signed J.J. Watt and A.J. Green, and I was like, yeah, that's what bad teams do. They sign 32-year-old people to third contracts, and but the combination of J.J. Watt and Chandler Jones is really good right now. And I didn't expect it, especially against a team like the Titans, who should be able to hammer that kind of defense specifically, right? And because the Cardinals statistically have not handled that kind of offense well in their own division for a long time. And so nothing made sense to me there.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great game plan, clearly, by Vance Joseph, but also impressive individual performances led by Chandler Jones. The Titans' offense just looked a little bit off. I mean, they did lose their offensive coordinator, so maybe there is a period of adjustment. Julio Jones was a big offseason acquisition, but the timing didn't look 100% there between him and Ryan Tannehill, and it just looked like they were just kind of a little bit discombobulated. And, you know, Gary mentioned Badgley, and of course this has been, you know, kind of a running narrative through our podcast, but you never like to see a kicker struggle or any player struggle. And it does raise the question, though, the kicker has been an Achilles heel to keep that thread running in this section for the Titans, and they're still searching for an answer at that position. And obviously that wasn't the only difference maker in the game, but it certainly didn't help. So I would say I regret picking the Titans to win the division, but we saw the Jaguars, we saw the Colts. I mean, it was kind of a
It's the Texans are the only team they're chasing right now.
That's right, exactly. So I don't know what to make of the Titans team, but they just looked off all around, and defense just looked like there was a ton of miscommunication, like entirely unprepared, outmanned, and so there were some issues on that side of the ball as well.
I will say they're just there's something to be said for an offense like the Titans, you know, that sort of wide zone approach where you get knocked off schedule and it really just throws everything off. And they've shown some comeback ability. Generally, Tannehill has not been great in like third and long situations, but when you're in a situation where you need to score a lot of points, like string together a lot of touchdown drives very quickly, it just sort of it throws your entire game plan in the trash at that point, and that's kind of what happened in this one. And then on top of that, yeah, Chandler Jones was incredible. He finished with 5 sacks and 2 forced fumbles. J.J. Watt was really good on the other side, but Connor, you do not have to walk back the A.J. Green claim at this point. He did not look any better than he did last year.
And just to circle back to, if I was a kicker, I would not want the Deadpool rocket leg, right? You would want to keep everything, because then you'd have to recalibrate everything, right?
Yes, yep.
You know, and then we'd have field goals from 98 yards out, and then Jason Garrett would be considered a good offensive coordinator again because you could always play for field goals, and you know the whole thing would ruin a lot. So to close the book on rocket legs, it's only for old 30-plus-year-old defensive players, and then we're not going to let anybody else get it, or running backs, because running backs should be able to have it.
Yeah,
too.
It's a limited customer base right now, but we'll see if we can get something going with the specialists. Let's turn it over to the lightning round, I guess. Yeah, this is like the lightning round part of show. And we will start with, we'll start with Jason Garrett and the Giants and Broncos, and Connor Orr, you were there in person to witness this.
So, yeah.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay. It's fine. On Sundays, what I normally do is I'll write after the first game, and then I'm usually done writing by like the end of the first quarter of the second games, and then I'll watch all the second games and then be done. I'll write something off that. And so I was at the Giants game, and you know, all this cool stuff was happening, and so I talked to editor Mitch, and he was like, the Giants and what's going on there is like the 90th most interesting thing. So while you're there, don't write anything about what's happening, because it's just uninteresting. And I tend to agree. So this is the fourth home opener loss in 5 years for the Giants and the 10th home opener loss in their last 11 years. And everything about this team just looks bad. But the one thing that, like, I think for some reason no one's allowed to say there is that Jason Garrett's a really bad offensive coordinator. He's just really bad. And the whole thing is super boring. They came out in the pistol in the first snap, and everyone was like, oh, here comes sexy Jason Garrett.
Comes that offense from 2014.
I was going to say, yeah. Remember when the pistol was a thing a decade ago?
Jason Garrett is like the dad who comes home and after the marriage has gone cold and he doesn't realize that it takes a lot to fix this, is going to be like, have you heard of hibachi? Let's go to Benihana and everything's going to be fine. Like, this place, they cook the food right in front of you. And that's kind of where the Giants are at right now, is where it's so far beyond Benihana. And yet they're trying Benihana, and I don't know what's going to fix this. Saquon Barkley is like just one of the most phenomenally giftedly athletic people I've ever seen, and just cannot get any open space to run. Daniel Jones is put into horrible positions with no open wide receivers. Sterling Shepard was the only guy that was really open at all, and you got clubbed by a Broncos team that was literally just running play action boots like all game. Now, granted, this is going to be a top five Broncos defense, so a tough opponent to start against for Jason Garrett. But then again, you're Jason Garrett. You've been an offensive coordinator in this league for like 20 years. Like, you got to be able to figure that out.
Yeah, it just feels like the Giants are a team that's been stuck in neutral for so long, and it's the same story every season, and you keep thinking, like, maybe this is the one thing that will change it. And this year, you know, maybe this is the year that Daniel Jones takes a step forward, and then he has, what was it, his 40th fumble or 40th turnover?
Turnover, I think,
40th turnover, yeah. So, I mean, it's just like watching the same play over and over again. But I will use your stat about the slow starts, because I was talking to my friend Eugene, who works in my building, and he was like, well, I'm not concerned as a Giants fan because they always start slow, which evidently is true given those stats, Connor. But the other side to that is that then they don't really get fast at any point, except for the two Super Bowl runs this millennium.
Yeah, I think that's all you could really do if you're trying to be optimistic, is you shrug your shoulders and be like, oh, it's a really good opponent. And also, like, the receivers missed most of the summer, the two new guys you brought in. But, yeah, it's just like, I'm with you in Saquon Barkley, because it's like,
so
I remember
good.
When he's coming out, it's kind of like, boy, the things they're going to be able to do with him. And it turns out, like, yeah, we're going to sort of run him on some inside zone stuff, and then sometimes like outside zone, and like that's it. It's like, I don't know. I'm with you. And I don't know how it gets fixed.
I have one more complaint too. And then you draft Kadarius Toney. Like, we're giving all these amazingly athletic people to Jason Garrett. Why are we doing this? Why? This is like, I don't want to take it back to, I made a pants analogy a few episodes ago, and mm-hmm. I don't want anybody to have to think about that again, but, you know, when like there's a really big fad in school, like when I was in school, it was the Old Navy tech vest. I don't know if you remember that. It was like a zip up fleece with no sleeves on it.
Old Navy performance fleece.
Old Navy performance fleece. That's what it was.
Yep.
Yes. And it had the song and everything, the commercial with the song. And then you would see someone, and I guess a lot of people probably thought it me when I was wearing it, but like you'd see a total goober have it, and you were like, why is this guy get a performance fleece? Jason Garrett is the guy with the performance fleece, and you're like, he doesn't, what is he performing in? He doesn't need this thing. And so I don't like his offense, and I wish that they would give it to somebody else. Give somebody else the performance fleece.
It's really a bummer. I'm still holding out hope for Daniel Jones, but he's not getting a chance here. And by the way, I love that the first segment of the lightning round just took 20 minutes and involved Old Navy performance fleece. Chargers and the football team down in Washington. And by the way, we'll get to it in a second, but the Eagles are the only team in the NFC East who won a game this week. So again, Giants just chasing one team, and it was the preseason, I don't know, last place projected team by this podcast. So anyways, Chargers got out of Washington. I'll say this about the Chargers. Washington played this game on their terms. They lost Ryan Fitzpatrick. So Tyler Heinicke, the taxpayer, goes in there and you know, does fine. So that's the only thing I was excited about this weekend. But yeah, this was kind of played on Washington's terms, and the Chargers still end up coming away with a win, which I think is just significant for a team that, and it's week one, we're drawing big, broad conclusions off of very small sample sizes. I do think it's significant for a team that sort of found creative ways to lose games over the last couple of years.
And I think the way that they won was really Justin Herbert. Like, he looked seasoned beyond his years. He looked beyond a second-year quarterback to kind of take hold of a game that, you know, could have gone the other way very easily and just make the throws that he needed to make, and some courageous throws, right? There was the third and long late in the game where they, you know, even the broadcasters are like, yeah, they'll probably just do a draw play. And I was thinking, I don't know if Justin Herbert's going to do a draw play here. And he didn't. They converted it. And I think that shows the confidence that he is a quarterback, obviously the confidence his coaches have in him, but that's why there are high hopes for the Chargers this year, is because of Justin Herbert.
Maybe the upset of the day, the Bengals winning overtime over the Vikings here. And look, Joe Burrow looked sort of cool, calm, and collected. We were kind of worried, would he be really skittish in the pocket? He wasn't. Now, they did. They leaned on the run. They led for a large part of this game. It's a lot of play action. It is what the Bengals want to do. It wasn't sort of like putting it on Joe Burrow's back and letting him try to go here. But they held up well. And also, you know, rest in peace to the Ja'Marr Chase can't catch a football storyline. That was so much fun this summer. He was targeted 7 times, caught 5 of them, including a 50-yard touchdown pass. He was really impressive. And the Bengals get a really solid win over a Vikings team that is maybe not vintage Vikings, but still kind of okay.
Still got blown up a few times when that interior offensive line broke down, which, you know, I will still jump on the table and say they needed to do a better job addressing. But you get your win against the Vikings, so good for you.
Yeah, and people had fired Zach Taylor essentially before the season started, so this was a good start for him.
Yeah, he did. They did the 4th and inches play action to set up the game-winning field goal in overtime as well, so that's a little bit gutsy, just a little bit. 49ers go to Detroit, and they start the season with a lost fumble on a quarterback-center exchange, and we all waited for, Jimmy Garoppolo to head to the bench, and he did for one play, but mostly the 49ers just sort of did whatever they wanted to the Lions defense here, which wasn't shocking. At one point, they were averaging 10 yards per play in the second half, and it was just kind of a mismatch. The Lions ended up making it interesting in the end, but I think this one kind of went as, everyone expected it to go.
I will say this, though, that, you know, this is a team that put up 33 points, and, Anthony Lynn, did what he did with Justin Herbert and the Chargers last year and is still kind of maximizing Jared Goff and the Lions. And so there's something to be said for that. But my takeaway here was that by just injecting Trey Lance very slowly into this game, like Kyle Shanahan is playing a very interesting long game. And I think that he's going to be able to introduce and sort of ebb and flow Trey Lance's entry into these games throughout the season. It's going to be really difficult for defensive coordinators to kind of gauge. I will, as we always do, bring it back to the 2011 Jets, where they signed Tim Tebow because they liked the idea of not necessarily what it did on the field, but what it forced the other teams to prepare for. I don't know if you remember that, Jenny, like they would always say, well, the amount of time that coaches left, what are they doing, but this is the actual version of that. This is what happens when you get a good player in there. Like now, by doing that for one snap or one series, or I think it was 2 or 3 snaps on Sunday, now next week everyone says, well, are they going to do a Trey Lance package? Are they not going to do it? And, we're going to have to pull off a defensive assistant to go watch Trey Lance and do all this stuff, and we're going to have to add a period in practice because of that. And so I think that was a valuable thing to do. It's a smart thing to do. And it continues our prediction, Trey Lance, offensive rookie of the year, by saying that they were going to slowly integrate him, let him score a couple times early in the season before taking the reins. So all is good there.
Okay. Well, earlier in the show, when I mentioned that Mac Jones had the best performance of the rookies this first week was really just to bolster my rookie of the year pick as well. So,
Well, Trevor Lawrence should get it for putting up what he puts up with Jacksonville.
At least we're not Gary over there.
Still alive, Connor.
Eagles go down to Atlanta and just sort of smush the Falcons here. I will say Jalen Hurts really proving the people who drafted him and are so desperate to move on from him wrong in this one. And Nick Sirianni had a good plan for him, use his legs a little bit. Jalen Hurts sprinkled in a couple of improvisational plays that were really impressive. And this was an Eagles veteran defense that really had its way with Arthur Smith's team in his Falcons debut.
Yeah, Eagles atop the NFC East right now. I mean, anything can happen. But yeah, it was a good performance for Hurts. I mean, he probably surprised people even within the organization, as you alluded to, Gary. So, if they see him as a placeholder quarterback, he's certainly going to do everything he can to justify hanging on to the job for longer than that.
Falcons head coach Arthur Smith with my favorite quote of the week: I did a real poor job getting us ready, and I feel awful for our fans. What a wonderfully humble thing to say. Like, guys, I'm sorry. This is not what I expected.
It was
so awesome.
And I have to say that I really appreciate the person who replied to your tweet of that on Twitter and said that that was Connor after his first Mad Libs foray.
Yes.
Which was so spot on and yep. such an own that I yes. just really appreciated that.
I felt owned the entire way home in the car for that.
Arthur Smith also could not figure out what a gerund was in his Falcons debut here. And last one here, Panthers and Jets. Sam Darnold gets his sweet, sweet revenge on the Jets. He was fine today. I mean, it's the Panthers. I thought both these teams were what we expected them to be. The Panthers were kind of, you know, up and down offensively, but did a few big plays. Their defense is really fast and might be really good this year. And then on the Jets side, it's a defense that's a work in progress and a quarterback that's a work in progress who's, you know, sprinkled in a couple of nice throws, but overall looked like a rookie quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, the Sam Darnold, Robbie Anderson touchdown really had to sting for a lot of people who follow the Jets,
yep.
but probably felt really good on the other side. And yeah, it's just hard to make any sweeping conclusions about Zach Wilson after that game and perhaps all of this season, you know? I mean, it's going to some of these teams where we see there's a new quarterback coming in, like we discussed with Trevor Lawrence, and there's a lot of issues around them, right? So we have a lot more to see and a long way to go for these young quarterbacks.
I'll give the Jets credit. You know, I think at the beginning of the year, I think we all said that the one thing that would be nice would be to see some fight in this team, you know, to see them hang around games in the second half. And they were down 16 points and they made it somewhat interesting. And, you know, I mean, this team doesn't have a whole lot. You know, Mekhi Becton was probably one of the last good things that, you know, that they had remaining on that roster to try to build a foundation off of. And then he goes ahead and gets injured as well. And so tough when you're running an outside zone offense and you can't run outside zone to do a whole lot of stuff, but Zach Wilson actually, I think, kind of kept them into games a little bit. Now, Corey Davis made some nice catches too there to bail him out, but you know, as long as there's some display of toughness there, I think that that's an improvement from what it was before.
All right, guys, we did it. 14 games on Sunday. We just broke them all down for you, and we're going to be maybe not doing all 14 every week, but we're going to be back here every Monday morning. So if you don't already, go ahead, subscribe, rate, and review, and we'll see you next week. The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is Jenny Brentis, Connor Orr, and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. And thanks, as always, to senior producer Dan Bloom, who gives us the best feedback every week. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB, and Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed on Apple Podcasts. And once you do, leave a rating and review because it really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.